The exception is driving while suspended. The conviction results in a mandatory suspension of your license. People don't go to jail for these traffic offenses, but the sanction of a suspension and also the requirement of proof of future responsibility through insurance companies is a deterrent. And I believe that by going to an infraction status, I don't believe that mandatory suspension could result in, and under the present law, there'd be no proof of future responsibility required. Also, if the person's convicted, no matter if it's an infraction or not, it would go on their driving record, and I'm sure insurance companies would pay attention to that fact. If there's a reckless driving on the record, someone quite possibly is going to have to pay a higher rate. They're a risk in the eyes of the insurance industry. So again, I would recommend that if this subcommittee is going to refer this bill to the full committee, that at least major traffic offenses be exempted. I have prepared an amendment to Judge Snapper's amendment, which I believe would accomplish that approach.
Representative
Jerry, just a clarification on your earlier point about how this is going to affect the test or standard that the police apply when they make an arrest. First of all, do you think that means there are going to be more arrests? And secondly, let me ask one step up the ladder. Do not district attorneys also use, if you will, the jury trial, the beyond a reasonable doubt, to wash out cases that they feel uncomfortable about as well?
They do today, but I'm saying under this approach, they would not necessarily be able to say that to a police officer or a victim, because people would know that the prosecutor would have the authority to downgrade it to much lesser burdens of proof. I wanted to follow up on one other item that Judge Snapper brought up, this reduction of a theft down to an attempted criminal mischief in the third degree. There's a little bit of a difference there, because the prosecutor is making the charging decision, is reducing it down to a lesser offense. It's quite clear that it's not as serious by just the fact that it isn't a violation. It doesn't sound as serious, and it's not a theft conviction. And that is another concern. It's just the characterization. Attempted criminal mischief in the third degree is just when the person interferes or attempts to interfere with another's property. But the theft, they'd have to prove an intent to permanently deprive. So I again believe that has to do with provability. There's a theft, and they probably know it's a repeat offender or it's someone who they want to get a conviction, but they can't prove it is under the proof beyond a reasonable doubt doctrine, so they go down to a violation. But they're changing the nature of the offense as well. So I feel, I've never heard of that in Washington County, but I just feel that's part of the prosecutor's charging decision. What can he prove? In Washington County, I think we would take the position, if we can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or there's no likelihood of it, we won't charge the offense. Or take an attempted theft, too, if there's some type of attempted aspiration. But that would still be a misdemeanor.
Ms. Breyer.
Is there, and maybe others want to respond to this, I mean, is there anything now among the arguments that have been presented that would prevent the DA from, at the first impression, from charging, you know, instead of charging theft in the second degree, reviewing the rap sheet or the Chris and say, we're going to make a charging decision right up front before we even get to the arraignment stage, we're going to treat this as an attempt crim mischief in the third degree, or
no? There's nothing preventing them from doing that.
You're saying under present law?
Under present law.
Nothing at all.
Mr. Larson.
Thank you. My name's Bob Larson. I'm the director of the Public Defender's Office in Lane County.
Thank you, Jerry.
I want to get back to Chairman Meyer's first question regarding the Brown analysis. I think there are two things that we should look at in terms of indicia of criminal cases that have not been touched on in the testimony. One is that on a violation, it's the position of some of the judges, and in fact it is done, that a person can be put on probation to the Department of Corrections for 5 years. And I haven't heard that issue addressed by the proponents of this bill, but I submit to you if that issue is raised, That'll be one of the factors that an appellate court would look at. I did not see that it was raised in Tuttle from looking at the opinion. I can't tell how it was briefed. The second issue would be the issue of putting a person on community service as authorized by the statute for a violation without the protection of assistance of counsel. I suggest to you that that would also raise the issue of the right to counsel in that type of case. Those are the two points that I wanted to address in addition to those matters that have already been discussed in the correspondence and in the testimony. And rather than repeat that to hear my own voice, I thought perhaps we just move on and go back to one of the fundamental questions in analyzing whether you're going to pass legislation or not, and that is there a need for the legislation? We took 10 Oregon counties and surveyed the filings in those 10 Oregon counties for the years 1980, 81, and 82. And those Oregon counties, for the record, were Clackamas, Coos, Deschutes, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Lane, Multnomah, Yamhill, and Washington. And the reason we took 10 is the reports to the Supreme Court Administrator for all the counties are not in yet, okay, for year 1982. But we tried to take counties with heavy populations, counties with medium population, counties with low population. The result in comparing those statistics and case filings were that over a two-year period, from 1980 to 82, there was an increase in those total 10 counties and filings of 85 felonies. For misdemeanor charges, which you're more concerned with here today, there was a negative decrease of 2,984 misdemeanors for those 10 counties over a two-year period. One of the counties we've been hearing concerns expressed about in relationship to misdemeanors has been Multnomah County. Filings in 1980 in misdemeanor violations, 24,126. 1981, a drop to 20,859. 1982, 22,227. These statistics, if you take a look, would indicate, obviously, I think the safest thing, without being an advocate, simply to say that there's a real question where we're going in terms of criminal case filings in the state. It appears that we're at least plateauing and we may be heading down, and I don't feel comfortable about saying anything more than that. But the reason, again, we're talking about these statistics, again, my understanding of the proposed legislation is to save cost for indigent defense because we don't want to spend money for court-appointed counsel. And I'm suggesting to you that the problem, although it is there, is one that we can meet and have been able to meet in the past, and we will continue to be able to meet even in these economic times. I don't think I have anything more to say. I think it's been pretty well said in the letters, with the exception of one point. I am still concerned about the idea of the legislature delegating basically to 36 district attorneys and then to their deputies the power to charge without standards and to make charging decisions as to when an action is going to be a crime and when it is not. The same act in Multnomah County may result in a criminal conviction. The act in Lane County may not. I'm also concerned about one other thing I heard Judge Snaufer say today is, well, it's a crime, but it's not going to be a crime, but we're going to call it a crime. Now, I don't understand. And I don't think a defendant's going to understand when he or she has been told, well, you really haven't been convicted of a crime, even though it shows up as a criminal conviction. You can sort of explain that it's a violation, maybe, if you can get the FBI to understand that when the conviction goes in on the rap sheet, it really shouldn't because it wasn't a crime. Just a lot of problems with it. I submit to you that there's not a need for it. It's going to raise problems. It's going to raise litigation, obviously. And what our courts will do with it, I, like the others, will not make any predictions.
Thank you. Questions of any of the witnesses? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I asked Judge Snaufer, my concern is for the, it seems that the discretion is purely in the hands of the district attorney, and I'm concerned about the defendant who is charged with a misdemeanor feels that they're innocent. And at this point, trying to make a decision as to whether they want to go to trial or not. And it would seem to me that you would need the advice of a lawyer to know whether you wanted to be tried or not. And yet they would be deprived of that, advice, without ever having the opportunity to talk to counsel. Is that what would happen under this bill? I mean, could that happen under this bill?
Well, I'm not really sure, President Hill, that I understand your question. A person is arrested, let's say, for shoplifting.
Yes.
They come in, and right now the district attorney could, customarily in a shoplift situation, I think in Multnomah County, certainly, and perhaps many of the other counties, the person is arrested by the store security people.
Yes.
Okay. They call the police officer. The police officer comes. The defendant is in custody of store security people. The officer writes out a ticket or a citation, gives it to that person, says, come to court in 2 weeks. The person comes to court 2 weeks later. At that point, the district attorney can either charge the person with theft in the second degree or could charge the person, as Representative Springer suggested, with attempted criminal mischief in the third degree. Now, in the one situation, would clearly be a criminal prosecution, and the DA has indicated we want this to go as a criminal prosecution. Perhaps the person has two priors or something of that sort, or another conviction. In the other situation, where it's attempted criminal mischief in the third degree, there is no right, it is a violation, there is no right to a court appointed attorney, and there is no right to a jury trial.
And so the defendant basically has no say.
That's right. It's a charging decision by the district attorney. That's the law occurring. There's no change in that respect that's brought about by this bill.
And if they make a request for counsel, it can just be denied because of the reduction of charge.
I would say, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, this is not a criminal case. You're not going to be convicted criminally. There's not any jail penalty involved in this situation, and I cannot appoint an attorney for you. In any situation now, currently, where a person is charged with violation, there is no right to court appointed counsel. And to the extent that some of the statements here have suggested that the district attorney can just arbitrarily choose to, under this statute, to charge somebody with a violation because they're a nice-looking young man, and charge the next defendant because they're a terrible-looking old man. I think it's very clear from all of our prior discussions under this bill that that's the improper criteria by which to make the decision whether or not to reduce it to a violation. What is not invited here is that the district attorney in making this decision is going to have some objective criteria.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Perhaps I've misrecalling the total effect of the amendments, but that the discretion of the district attorney is not restricted by this bill, though, is it?
No, there's nothing in the bill that says that the district attorney has to file with the court a statement of criteria by which it will be determined whether or not to proceed as a violation or as a crime. That's we had a discussion here, and Mr. Cooper was involved, President Dyke was involved, and I think we all agreed pretty well that the district attorney, either orally in court at the time of the arraignment or in writing ahead of time, could file with the court a set of criteria by which certain cases would be treated as a violation as opposed to a crime. And it might be simply as now exists in Multnomah County, first theft offense where the property involved is $50 or less would be treated as a violation. Anything over that is treated as a crime and proceed in the murder session. That's filed ahead of time. I think those are sufficiently objective criteria that would withstand scrutiny, at least under the strict scrutiny test, the federal approach that Gary was referring to. I'm not prepared to deal with the balancing approach that he was discussing.
Judge Hargreaves.
part of the discussion brings me back, if I can now, to a problem that I think has been kind of overlooked in this question, and I think your exchange with Judge Snopper sort of raises that specter again, and that is that I really believe that a number of people have written off the case of State versus Perkey too easily and too soon. Perkey was the main case for years in the state of Oregon, prohibiting exactly the kind of thing that we're seeing here, that is, crime with the same elements being, in Perkey, it was the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. Here we're talking about the misdemeanor to a violation. And Perkey was the law in Oregon for a long time, then came along the case, the name of which escapes me, except it ends with the city of Klamath Falls. Winters versus City of Klamath Falls, which said, well, we don't, Perkey's no longer good law based on federal constitutional standards. But given State versus Carriker, which the Oregon Supreme Court has recently put forth and have struck out on their own in the area of Fourth Amendment and talk very strongly about the strength of the Oregon Constitution and the analysis that needs to be done under the Oregon Constitution, I think that there is a real possibility that Perkey could be alive and well under the Oregon Constitution, and that because of just the kind of thing that Representative Meyer is talking about and the kinds of things that were discussed in Perkey, that we could be right back into breathing life into State versus Perkey, as well as having our Brown problem. And I think one should not write off State versus Perkey that easily. I think there's a substantial question there whether that case is still going to be alive and well in the state of Oregon under the Oregon Constitution.
Mr. Springer, did you have a question?
No, cool.
Somebody else?
No. Well, I heard for the first time, I think, today that we were talking about that there was some sort of legislative intent as to standards. I mean this quite sincerely, I haven't heard that. And I would raise the question, if there's some sort of nebulous legislative intent, it probably should be reduced to written standards within the bill. Also, the question then comes up, what would happen if the prosecutor sitting in Deschutes County decided his or her standards would be, we will not prosecute any thefts because as crimes if it's over $100, and then in Lane County, the decision is thefts under $50. I think there's, then that raises another constitutional issue, depending on what part of the state you're in, as to what you're going to be charged with. That would cause me some concerns. It also would then appear to be a delegation of local lawmaking, a criminal lawmaking authority to various counties. And if that's the case, that's prohibited by the Oregon Constitution. In those articles that I cited to you, and I don't want to, in correspondence to this committee. So again, I see some problems. And I remember, I think it was arguing with Mr. Gary in the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon on a case where we were talking about security and bail, and a case called Sexton v. Merton. And I started citing some legislative history, and the reaction I got from two or three of the judges about my interpretation of what your intent was they didn't want to, they were interested, but they really weren't interested. What did it say in black and white? And I would suggest that one should not rely on legislative intent very strongly as an argument. I don't want to have to do that 2 years from now. If that's what you mean, I request that you amend the bill to that effect.
Jerry Cooper, once again, my recollections of the meeting that I attended with Chris Van Dyke, who's represented the District Attorneys Association, was that he personally would have no problem with setting up some type of criteria to be used and would even be published in Marion County. But he couldn't speak to the 35 other district attorneys as to how they would react to that or would be interested in setting up some criteria, unless the statute required it.
Well, I thought I broached that question in one of our hearings and got the usual reaction. No, we don't want to get, and I think I understand why, because once we start down that track, and we ought to, it will, I think, pull the legislature gradually toward, one way or another, imposing requirements or standards as to other aspects of prosecutorial discretion. Now that is coming someday. I don't know if it will be in my lifetime. Someday that's going to be the law in one form or another, I'm convinced of it. Even if it's no more than to say that the Attorney General will promulgate standards recommended for the district attorneys with respect to various areas of discretion. But I got a very definite feeling that that was going to produce a good deal of opposition to the bill from prosecuting attorneys. I think I got the idea pretty clearly. May be necessary for the subcommittee to have a chance to reflect a bit further on the analysis that's been submitted. While we have you all here, because I don't want to have to drag all of you back for a final discussion of this bill in work session, unless it's absolutely necessary, I'd like to see, well, first of all, let me thank all of you for the thoughtful analyses you provided each other and to the committee. It's been very, very helpful, believe me. And we appreciate that time and effort. I'd like to ask Linda if there are any other issues that we ought to review in the context of the amendments previously adopted while we have this entire group here. We can take advantage of the opportunity to get any responses from them.
Mr. Chair and committee members, one of the aspects I think that remained, I don't remember this being answered, I still have it in my mind as a concern, is in the amendment to section 1 subsection 6, there was the original, I don't know if it was the original idea, but throughout the discussions it came up that this whole matter is to be looked upon as a charging decision to be made by the district attorney, and yet that amendment still leaves in certain instances the decision to the court in whether the offense is going to be reduced to a violation in the circumstances where the district attorney either doesn't provide advice to the court as to its intention of reducing it, or where the district attorney states that they take no position in it, it still leaves that to the court to reduce it. And I think it troubles me still as being a mixture of a charging decision and a decision that a court can make before the court necessarily has any particular evidence or facts before it on which to base the decision. I don't know what they'd be basing it on. And I don't know what other people have thoughts about it, but that's one thing that troubled me. One is in section 2, in the definition of that's amendments to the definition of a violation, and it states that an offense is a violation if the statute designates it as that, or if the accusatory instrument designates that the offense is charged as a violation, or if the DA moves to reduce a misdemeanor to a violation and the court designates it. In that second part where it says that the accusatory instrument may designate that the offense is charged a violation, it doesn't specify that that offense is limited to misdemeanors, although it's my understanding that your intent is to limit that ability only to misdemeanor cases. So that's perhaps more technical if I'm understanding the intent correctly. And that same applies in Section 3, amending ORS 161575, that says any violation defined in the criminal code is expressly designated in the section defining the offense or is designated as a violation in the accusatory instrument and doesn't specifically limit it to misdemeanors. And I think some of the others are maybe more policy type of issues like the traffic offenses and how those ought to be treated.
Judge, you wish to comment on those points?
Just one by one, yes. We spent quite a bit of time, I think, over the past meetings talking about the court's authority to take some initiative and require the district attorney to make an urgent decision, and that's all that last sentence is there to try to accomplish. And the amendments came about primarily because of the input by the District Attorneys Association that they want not to be sandbagged by a court, and if they don't have information about the defendant that meets the criteria that they may establish to choose whether or not to select a criminal or violation prosecution, they want to be able to say, Judge, we want to continue this case as a crime, in which case the court has no authority to produce it. If the district attorney simply says to the court, I'm not talking about that, then the court, and this is the thinking of the commission on the judicial branch, was that the court ought to have some means, limited as this is, it really is, I think, kind of limited, to say to the district attorney, look, take a look at your case, evaluate your case, decide whether or not you're going to prosecute as a crime or as a violation. So, to the extent that the question is, what would the court look at in trying to make a determination that, assuming no input from the district attorney, how would the court decide whether to treat it as a violation? I think the court would have to have a rational set of criteria by which to determine that. Can't just arbitrarily and say, well, this is a good looking young man and doesn't seem like a nice kid, wants to give me a break and charge him for a violation. The court is going to have to have some standards by which to decide how to act if the district attorney takes no position. With regard to the other amendments in section.
It's your idea that the courts as well would adopt standards and criteria for when, in these circumstances where the DA didn't take a position or whatever.
Each on a rational basis, sure. And realize too, the court, if it's a conservative court and says, hey, I don't want any part of this, this is strictly a prosecutor's function, the court has that option to take, just do nothing about it. Goes on. With regard to the other two responses to sections 2 and section 3, those statutes simply define what a violation is. And right now, the district attorney has printed forms that will charge the accusatory instances of complaints charging a misdemeanor case, for example. And what's contemplated here is that if it gets issued on that printed form initially, and a few weeks later, 2 weeks later, whenever the defendant first comes into court, the district attorney says, we've had enough time now to evaluate it, this person meets our criteria, we move to reduce it to a violation. It would simply be written notations on the printed forms that it is no longer defined as a violation. And for record keeping purposes and conviction purposes, it would show as a violation of his criminal conviction. Or, where it says here, or if the accusatory instrument designates the offense, is charged as a violation, I could contemplate that actually the district attorney will have printed forms for that county saying violations and use those instead of pre-printed misdemeanor. But what is attempted to be accomplished there is simply that charging portion of the complaint clearly designate whether it's a crime or whether it's a violation. And this sets forth all the possible variations on that theme. So far as the worry that somebody is going to take a felony and bust it all the way down to a violation, they have that authority right now. And there are situations where police go out and they make an arrest and their evaluation is it's a felony crime. And it's reviewed by the district attorney and they reduce it down to a violation. They could reduce it, or to a misdemeanor, they could reduce it all the way to a violation. They have any discretion to do so now.
To reduce any felony to a violation? What would they call it?
Well, You could charge somebody initially with burglary, for example. Let's say the person broke into a supermarket at night, they committed a burglary, and for whatever reasons, they decided to charge only this attempted criminal mischief in the third degree because he tampered with the person's property. It could be done. It's not likely. It's not likely. There's nothing here that's going to give the district attorney any greater leeway in charging the police.
But the attempted criminal mischief 3 only does fit certain circumstances. I mean, any felony in the world can't end up as an attempted criminal mischief 3.
But again, keep in mind what Mr. Van Dyke said previously. This would be, I don't agree with the problem of county by county differing treatment that exists in the state has for years, and it's certainly a problem. District attorney in each county is elected to represent the people, and he or she is making totally outrageous charging decisions that will come up in the next election.
Can I respond to that, at least on the diversion?